I'm William O'Flaherty. Welcome to All About Jack and the Knowing and Understanding C.S. Lewis YouTube channel. Dr. Don King joins me to discuss a book new for 2023, Inkling, Historian, Soldier, and Brother, A Life of Warren Hamilton Lewis. Just a brief note, stay tuned past the ending for a bonus question about Janie King Moore, who first lived with C.S. Lewis before Warren joined them to share a house. Welcome back to All About Jack, Don.
Good to be back, William. Always enjoy being with you.
Well, now, obviously, your subject is C.S. Lewis's brother, commonly referred to as Warnie. And while you state in your book that you avoid making the creator of Narnia, who was known as Jack, the centerpiece of your biography, because the two of them as brothers were so close, you couldn't help but write about, C.S. Lewis himself. So that said, you note in your introduction that Warnie's, quote, life sheds new light on his famous brother. Give us just a taste of what you share in your book.
Sure. I could probably pick a number of things, but two things come to mind right away. And the first is that although probably many know Jack's early biography well, I don't think they probably realize the amount of damage that was done both to Jack and Warnie when they were at the Wynyard School under the iron rule of Reverend Robert Capron, also called Oldie by the boys. I am able to document at some length through the account of someone who was at the school just previous to Warnie and Jack about several episodes of very specific brutality that Oldie practiced. And certainly, you know, it would have both Warren and Jack would have experienced that as well. Warnie concludes his description of Capron by saying, "I failed in my description if I have not shown you a powerful, violent, brutal man without intellectual tastes or attainments. Regarding his school as at once a merely livelihood and a safety valve for his ill temper, who by secluding himself from all who are not under his domination, had reached such a degree of tyranny that the kindest verdict I can pass on him is that he was not quite sane." And so we really learn that Capron was cruel and unstable. He sort of sounds like a compilation of several characters out of the novels of Dickens, for instance, Mr. Machocum Child, the ruthless teacher in Hard Times, and Mr. Murdstone, David Copperfield's cruel stepfather in David Copperfield. But the point I wanted to make here is that both Warnie and Jack were intellectually and psychologically traumatized by their experiences with Capron. And I think it's something that they both take with them throughout the rest of their lives. The second thing worthy of note at this point is that after Jack and Mrs. Moore invited Warnie to live with them, after he retired from the Army in 1932, in a series of letters to Warnie, Jack tried to lay out the reality of living with Moore and her daughter Maureen and the odd collection of people Moore often had around her at the kilns. Here's just a brief excerpt from one of Jack's letters to Warren. "I suppose you do realize that to exchange an institutional for a domestic life is a pretty big change. Both kinds of life have their discomforts, and all discomforts are, in a sense, intolerable. The great thing is to choose with one's eyes open. Can you stand," he says to Warnie in this letter, "as a permanency, our cuisine? Can you stand Maureen's practicing the piano all the time? Can you stand Maureen's sulks? Can you stand Moore's episodes of just being upset, her mare's nests, the Pacific," and Lewis goes on to say, "and the perpetual interruptions of family life? Can you stand," he says to Warnie, "the partial loss of liberty?" And then he ends this sort of letter of warning to Warnie by saying, "This sounds as if I were either sick of it myself or else trying to make you sick of it, but neither is the case. I've definitely chosen, and I don't regret my choice. What I hope, very much hope, is that you, after consideration, may make the same choice and not regret it. What I can't risk is you're floating in on the swell of a mood and then feeling trapped and fed up. There's so much in that letter that bears additional discussion, because the point that Jack is trying to make to Warney is you really need to be prepared for coming and living in the environment of the kilns with these people that are not necessarily the kind of people Warney would want to spend his time with. And Jack goes out of his way to open Warney's eyes to what it's going to be like to live at the kilns when he ends up retiring from the army. So those are just two examples.
Okay, yeah, that paints a definitely interesting picture in terms of trying to describe what it's like to some extent. Well, now, as the title of your book states, Warney, in addition to being the brother of Jack, was also involved in the Inklings, which we'll talk about in a little bit, but he was a historian and also a soldier. Well, now, besides being the first to edit a collection of Jack's letters, what are some of the other titles that he published?
Well, he published seven books, all having to do with French history in the 17th century. And most of the books focus on Louis the 14th, sometimes referred to as the Sun King. And I think probably for tonight, probably the best thing for me to do is just focus on Warney's first book, The Splendid Century, the subtitle, Some Aspects of French Life in the Reign of Louis the 14th. This book was published in 1953, and I think Warney spent about really 15 years doing the research for this book. And what he does is write what I would call a social history of 17th century French history, focusing, of course, on Louis the 14th. But he considers things beyond just the court. He, for instance, deals with the question of the kind of medicine that was being practiced at this time. He dealt with the galleys, that is the way in which Huguenots, who were really persecuted by by Louis and by the whole society of 17th century France, and the way in which when these men were condemned to the galleys, it was a horrific kind of experience. He deals with education for women. He deals with what it would have been like to spend a day at the court with Louis the 14th. The techniques for dental treatment, I think, stand out as being very odd. For instance, one way in which I think a cavity was supposed to be treated was that you were supposed to grind up a worm and then put it on the open cavity and then seal it up. I'm not sure what they hoped that would accomplish, but yeah, I don't think it really was very effective. So he does in the other books, he doesn't just talk about Louis the 14th. He does talk about a number of the characters around Louis the 14th. But again, everything sort of turns on the Sun King, if you will, and on his life and on what was going on in France during the 17th century. I might add that one of the things I discovered is that Warney completed another manuscript in 1962 and 1963. And this was apparently a biography of the young Louis the 14th. And he made a number of revisions that were asked him to do by the publisher. But in the end, the New York publisher who had approached him decided not to accept the manuscript. Warney was not very happy about that, as I'm sure you can imagine.
Yes, it can be very disappointing to an author. and I had not heard that. I was familiar that he had written seven books. I don't know that I would have been able to quote the titles, but it is fascinating that Jack's brother, was a respected writer, even though he didn't write along the same lines that C.S. Lewis did.
Yeah, one of the things about Warney's histories is how well they were received, not just by the general public, but by historians of the time. And he was often referred to as probably the key memoir writer of 17th century French history during his own time.
Well, now, related to being a historian, let's get into what's called the Lewis Papers. We could probably do many, many podcasts to discuss that. But, you know, how difficult was it to organizing for Warney 80 years of family history? And what's maybe an example or examples of information you found that is among the most interesting or maybe unusual?
Yeah, when Jack and Warney actually together kind of looked at the papers they had after their father died, they realized they had an archive, a family archive consisting of letters, diaries, journals, essays, sermons, poems, newspaper clippings, illustrations, maps, photographs, drawings, short stories, anecdotes, legal papers, and miscellaneous documents. So when Warney began the project, he had a vast collection of these materials, including over 30 volumes of diaries and a large cache of unsorted papers. But I think what is impressive about what Warney does is that he does come up with an organizational strategy. It kind of is an obvious one. That is, he decided to arrange the documents in a chronological order. And that ensures that there's something of a loose narrative that results. But at the same time, there are oftentimes gaps and there are transitions that are made that as you read through the Lewis papers, it's sort of hard to follow that loose narrative that I was referring to. But, you know, it's a monumental accomplishment. He ends up editing all of the material into 11 volumes of the Lewis papers. And anyone who has written extensively on Lewis's life knows how valuable the Lewis papers are. Hal Poe, who I'm sure you've had on recently to talk about his 3-volume biography of Lewis, is just one of many biographers who have spent many hours going through what Warney did there with the Lewis papers. I think it might be worth pointing out, William, at this point, is that Warney's work on the Lewis papers had an effect on the relationship between the brothers that I think is rather profound. I mean, they already had a deep affection for one another, but I think that affection was enhanced in a number of ways because of what Warney did with the Lewis papers. For instance, first of all, I think Warney's work on the Lewis papers cemented the loving relationship that the two brothers had. What they had only known in part about themselves and their family was made more concrete because of what Warney did in his work on the Lewis papers. In a very real sense, they saw something of who they were via the lens of all of these family papers. Second, I think the Lewis paper objectified the personality of their closest relatives, particularly their father, Albert, with whom both, but especially Jack, had a conflicted relationship. But looking objectively and from a distance at their father's life, as revealed in his letters and essays and orations and court cases and legal papers and so forth, I think both Jack and Warney came to understand more about Albert and of course themselves than they ever did during his life. Thirdly, the Lewis papers were compiled on the heels of each brother's return to Christian faith, a faith very much in the tradition of their Irish Protestant heritage. So while both rejected in large part the rigid self-righteousness and inflexible anti-Catholicism of many of their Belfast relatives, they nevertheless were made keenly aware of the dangers of insular faith and social religion. So put another way, I think the family papers confirm the importance of a genuine non-sectarian Christian faith while at the same time bolstering the religious bond between the brothers. And then the last point I'll make is that I think that the Lewis papers clarify the lifelong love of writing that the two brothers shared. The Lewis papers were completed after Jack's The Pilgrim's Regress in 1933, but before his Allegory of Love that was published in 1936. In both books heralded the writing skills and the intellectual muscle that Jack would go on to evidence over the next 30 years. I don't think the Lewis papers are ever likely to be published, but they certainly signal that Warney was a gifted writer, particularly in his ability to organize materials, put them together, collate, and create a kind of understandable narrative. I think the Lewis papers also suggest that the brothers were collaborators, even as adults. So to sort of finish up here, I think Warney's gifts, including a highly retentive mind, wonderful organizational skills, single-minded commitment and determination, and his fine eye for characterization equipped him superbly during the years he labored to produce the Lewis papers. So that's just a little bit of what I could say.
Yes, there is so much that could be said just about that aspect, as well as other aspects of your book that we're not going to really get into. We're just kind of skimming the surface enough to give people a taste to want to get the book. Again, it's called Inkling, Historian, Soldier, and Brother, A Life of Warren Hamilton Lewis. Well, now, speaking of a soldier, which is, you know, obviously mentioned in the title here, his military experience was different than Jack's. What are a few examples of, well, as how it impacted his life?
Well, Warney served in a non-combat arm of the British Army, the Army Service Corps, that was responsible for a huge logistic and strategic movement of men and horses and equipment and food and so forth. So in that sense, that's a huge difference, because Jack was a frontline soldier. He was in the trenches. But I think one thing that's probably true of both of the brothers, but certainly is true of Warney, through his experience in World War I, he becomes what we might today say, he becomes a man through his service. You know, he grew up in a well-to-do middle-class family, and then he was an insulated schoolboy at both Malvern College and to some degree at Wynyard. Then he was a sequestered cadet at Sandhurst, the equivalent of our Annapolis. And so he had lived a sheltered, protected, and privileged life. He didn't have any firsthand knowledge of the way of the world. So when he's thrown into the battle, as was the case probably of hundreds of thousands of young men like him, he couldn't close his eyes to the horror that he saw. He also, for the first time, like his brother Jack, rubbed shoulders with men not of his class. And so he goes through quite a maturing process. He starts out with a second lieutenant at the beginning of the war, but by the end of the war, he's a captain, and he's responsible for overseeing equipment camps and about 200 men and officers. So he begins the war as a naive teenager, but emerges from it as a seasoned, disciplined officer. I think a second thing about his wartime experience is the way in which he, like many of the soldiers, engaged in heavy episodes of alcoholic dissipation. I don't think that in itself is surprising, given the alternating periods that he and the other soldiers experienced of long monotonous boredom and then intense, frightening peril. All of the soldiers, including Warney, had to find some way to cope during this time. So his drinking wouldn't have been an anomaly at the time, but more of an everyday fact of life. Still, I think that sets Warney on the road to becoming an alcoholic. I think he becomes an alcoholic almost certainly because of the patterns of drink he acquired during World War I. And then thirdly, I think an important part of World War I in terms of Warney's life is the fact that his life as a writer was stimulated by his wartime service. I mean, we might expect his many letters to his father to have been there. What could be more comforting to connect regularly back to life at home, where lay familiarity, warm memories of hearth and home, and so forth. But his wartime writing, the journal that he kept, and some of the letters that he wrote, they were really coping mechanisms. They were musings where Warney could process not only the simple everyday chronicle of his life, but also where he could explore deeper existential questions and matters common to all human beings. I'm sure he asked questions like, who am I? And why am I here? And where am I going? Often Warney's wartime writings capture the irony of the whole affair. For instance, in one letter he wrote, last night there was a glorious sunset, all crimson and gold, and not a gun to be heard anywhere. Somehow it suddenly struck me how silly the whole thing is. I don't know if you can understand what I mean, but on a lovely spring evening, why should some 5 million men be concentrating all their energy on the destruction of another 5 million men? So again, just being in the war caused him to look deeply inside and to think about, you know, these kind of existential questions that I've just suggested.
Well, now the title of your book begins with Inkling. So was Warney really all that involved in this group?
He certainly was. Most Inkling scholars consider that the original three Inklings were Tolkien and Jack and Warney. And I was amazed to find out, as I was wondering about how frequently Warney attended the Inklings meetings, I was amazed that no one had actually put together a study of the number of times that the Inklings either certainly met or possibly met. So one of the things I did was document that there were 93 documented meetings of the Inklings between 1933 and 1954. And then there were another possible 1,048 meetings of the Inklings during that same time period. So the documented meetings are the ones that where we have letters or journals or diary entries where usually Tolkien, Jack, or Warney would reflect on the meeting that they had just attended. But I think this is really interesting. There were possibly 1,141 gatherings of the Inklings if you include the documented meetings and then the ones that they might have met at. And if we assume that the average meeting lasted 2 hours, this means that the range of hours that some portion of the Inklings, because they weren't all ever at one meeting, but some portion of the Inklings collectively spent together falls somewhere between 186 and 2,282 hours.
Wow.
And so you can only imagine the range of serious discussions as well as the jokes and the teasing and the verbal horseplay that occurred during these meetings. And the other thing that I think is worth noting is that what we know about the documented meetings come either from Jack or from Tolkien or from Warney. Because of those 93 documented meetings, we find evidence in their letters and diaries of 84 of them. We find, for instance, in the collected letters of C.S. Lewis, Volume 2, Jack documents 15 meetings between October 1937 and February 1943. In the letters of Tolkien, he writes about 18 meetings between April 1944 and February 1952. But we owe most of what we know about the documented meetings to Warney, since he writes in his diary about 51 of them, or 55% of those gatherings between May 1945 and February 1951. So, Warney is the person we have to go to most frequently to find out what in the heck was going on in those meetings. And here's just a brief list of some of the topics covered at the meetings that Warney wrote about. So here's some of the things they talked about during these meetings: the possibility of dogs having souls, the morality of the Nuremberg trials, the possibility of communications with the dead, the moral aspects of atomic bombing and total war, second sight or the ability to perceive future or distant events, the ethics of cannibalism, and just as a footnote, are there ethics of cannibalism? I don't know. The impossible challenge of interesting the uneducated indifferent in religion, how far pagan mythology was a substitute for theology, the various versions of the Bible, Sherlock Holmes stories, public schools, and the problem of why some children are allowed to die in infancy. And then there are other topics as well, but those are some that I thought maybe your listeners would be interested in.
Yes, yeah, what you covered in your book is quite interesting. I could have joked was Warney the fifth inkling in the spirit of the fifth beetle, but you very clearly, and maybe I hadn't paid close attention to other material that talks about the inklings, but when you talk about like the top four inklings, usually Warney is not necessarily brought up in that spirit, but he was the third most common attendee of those meetings.
Right.
Well, now, finally, what was life like for Warney after Jack died 10 years before he did?
I think, in short, it was a pretty sad time. Throughout Warney's life, he dreaded the idea of Jack dying before him. And not only did Jack die before him, but Warney lived on another 10 years after Jack died. He didn't just lose himself in depression, however, although I think he did struggle with it quite a bit. He continued to read extensively. He continued to be a faithful member of Holy Trinity Church. He read the Bible regularly. One of the things that he liked to do was reread portions of his diary. And at one point, he edited a selection of over 60 of his earlier diary excerpts that gave him great pleasure. And he entitled these excerpts Happy Times. Interestingly, the excerpts cover the years between 1918 and 1954. And the majority of his happy times occurred between 1930 and 1939. Actually, 66% of all his favorite memories. All of those involved Jack and their 8 walking tours. We could probably spend a lot of time talking about those walking tours, but I think it's instructive that Warney, 66% of his happy times were covered by the 8 walking tours that he took with Jack during the 1930s. Warney loved to smoke, as did Jack, so he continued to enjoy smoking pipes or cigarettes. Walter Hooper said that Warney gave off an aroma of old books and tobacco whenever he was with him. And he said that Warney drank vast quantities of tea and even carried a flask up to bed with him every night so that he could enjoy an early morning cup without having to get up. Again, he read widely, many devotional works. He had great regard, by the way, for G.K. Chesterton's The Everlasting Man, which he said was the best piece of apologetic literature ever written. But he never recovered from losing Jack. I think with time, some of the pain was less sharp, became more of a dull throb, but still the sense of having lost his brother was ever present. At a number of points, his sorrow caused him to dream about Jack. In one dream, Warney thought he was among the dead, although he himself was alive. He described the place as a flat red-colored plain covered with flints under a leaden sky, with a great many listless, bored people mulling about. Suddenly, he saw Jack coming towards him, but when Warney tried to hug him, there was nothing but empty air. On another occasion, Jack appeared to Warney in a dream and asked for the return of his prayer book. But when Warney went to fetch it, Jack vanished and Warney woke up. 5 years to the day after Jack's death, Warney wrote in his journal or in his diary, "It's 5 years ago today that I lost my dear brother and it still hurts. Not, of course, any longer a constant ache, but only rarely does a day pass in which I do not miss him acutely and momentarily." He also reflected on how different he and Jack were. For instance, after giving up trying to read Jack's book, Studies and Words, Warney wondered, "He and I, born of the same parents, he so brilliant, I so much the reverse, how and why?" So I think it's very poignant, very tender, those last 10 years, as well as sad. He continued to struggle with alcohol. He had a number of alcoholic binges during those times. So not a total time of darkness, but sad and depressive.
And as we said at the start and alluded to during the interview here, there is so much more that we could talk about, but we want to make sure that people get a copy of your book. It's very well worth it, not only to learn about the fascinating life of Lewis's brother, but some things about C.S. Lewis as well, because their lives were very closely related. But again, Warney himself, a very fascinating and interesting life. And yeah, like one of the things that we're not touching on is at the end of your book, where you talk about very explicitly, although you related some during the book about what they have in common, you list almost two dozen things as well as some differences. We're not going to get into that, nor people have to look in your book. What Warney said was the two favorite books from his brother, Jack, as well. They'll have to read your book to find out. Well, speaking of books, go ahead and share some of your other writings as well as a little bit about yourself.
Well, this biography of Warney is my 11th book. 10 of my 11 books deal with C.S. Lewis and his friends in one way or another. My first book was on Lewis as a poet, and then I explored Lewis's relationship with the well-known poet in England anyway. From about 1930 to 1970, Ruth Pitter, I wrote her, I wrote a critical biography of her. I published her letters, and I published I guess we would call it the complete complexion of her poems. And then I turned to writing about the other important woman in Lewis's life, that is Joy Davidman. I published her letters, I published her poetry, and then I wrote a book on her as a writer. And so, you know, I don't want to, I probably don't have time to talk about all the others, but again, you know, this was my 11th book, and 10 of the books focus on Lewis and the people important to him.
Okay, yeah, and then I've interviewed you on quite a number of those, so we'll have a link in the show notes or description for people to find out about it. So, and then briefly share then about yourself.
Oh, well, I've, you know, married to my wife. We celebrate our 50th anniversary this coming July. Four children, 12 grandchildren, with another one, I think, on the way. I've taught at Montreat. Now, I realized that I'm in the midst of my 98th semester at Montreat. So this is my 49th year. I'm halfway through my 49th year at Montreat. Teaching primarily literature courses. I also teach in the honors program. I try to play golf, but I'm not very good, but I keep at it. So that's a little bit about me.
Okay. Well, and again, I'll have a link in the show notes for people to check out the other interviews where you also share other things about yourself and as well as the other writings. But we want to encourage people to stay tuned past the ending for a bonus question related to Janie King Moore. Well, Don, thank you for being on All About Jack.
Thank you. Again, pleasure to be here. Always love the time that we have together.
I trust you enjoyed my interview with Don King about Inkling historian, soldier, and brother, a life of Warren Hamilton Lewis. As noted already, keep listening past this ending for the bonus question related to Janie King Moore. Again, I'm William O'Flaherty. My podcast, All About Jack, has been around for over 10 years. And on YouTube, my channel is called Knowing and Understanding C.S. Lewis. Be sure to check out my 6-minute feature called The Latest on C.S. Lewis that focuses on timely and timeless information. Check the description or show notes for links to items mentioned in the show today. Finally, everything I do related to Lewis is centralized at my website, essentialcslewis.com. And in case you didn't know, I've written two Lewis-themed books. The Misquotable C.S. Lewis came out in 2018. It examines 75 quotations credited to him that he either didn't write, are paraphrases of something he did or without the context could be misunderstood. Then in 2016, my enhanced study guide to the Screwtape Letters was released. It's called C.S. Lewis Goes to Hell. Thanks again for listening. Please consider liking and sharing this episode with others. And stay tuned for the bonus question. Well, Don, it's already been revealed that Jack did have a physical relationship with Janie King Moore, and I'll have a link in the show notes about that. But now what I'd like you to briefly address is Warney's view of Moore and what his perspective might reveal.
It's a complicated question, but I'll try to answer it concisely. When Warney moved in with Jack and Mrs. Moore in 1932 at the Kilns, I think initially he hoped it would be a good time together. And the first year, I think things went pretty well. But within the 18 months, Warney was very unhappy living with Mrs. Moore for all kinds of reasons that people really need to read the book to find out the reasons why. But I wanted to kind of focus on this idea. At one point in Warney's diary, he talks about how when his brother met Mrs. Moore, he says it was a crushing misfortune. But I think it's worth pointing out that it wasn't just a crushing misfortune for Jack. It was perhaps a more crushing misfortune for Warney, because most of his life after World War I, and particularly after his retirement from the Army, most of his life was blighted by his years of living with Mrs. Moore at the Kilns. Within only a few years of moving to the Kilns, Warney was profoundly unhappy there. I would say that his relationship with Moore poisoned his life, making living at the Kilns like being in an unwelcoming army billet. I think it would be unfair to blame Moore for Warney's slide into alcoholism, but it has to be noted that his feelings towards her certainly led him to drink excessively at times as a way of coping with being around her. Secondly, at the center of the conflict between Warney and Moore was Jack. Both wanted the lion's share of his attention, and so they were jealous of each other. Moore replaced her son Patty, lost in World War I, with Jack, and she became possessive and obsessive about him, and she fought against anything or anyone that threatened their relationship. On the other hand, Warney longed to return to the idyllic days when he and Jack were in the little attic room at Leeborough, and he resented Moore's hold over Jack, finding it mysterious, bizarre, and quite frankly, pathological. So if two people ever fought each other over the soul of a third, it was Moore and Warney. And then finally, I think it's worth noting that both Moore and Warney were emotionally dependent persons. Both needed someone to serve as a beacon, to be the focus of their lives, lives that they sought to find meaning and purpose in what was oftentimes an existence marked by uncertainty, confusion, and heartache. So maybe the way to finish this up is to say that Warney and Moore would never have known each other, much less lived together for over 20 years, had not both loved Jack so much.